Welcome to Cooper Talk. I'm your host, Steve Cooper. And remember, I'm only as hip as my guest. And I got to tell you something, people. I remember it was my senior year in high school, and I was watching MTV, and I saw the band Haircut 100. And I loved the music. And next day, I borrowed my mom's car. It was a little brown Toyota station wagon. And I drove, and we used to have circles in New Jersey. Drove around the Ellisburg Circle to this record shop, and I bought the album. And I remember me and my friends listening to it, and we watched the video. And all the girls were crazy for the lead singer, who is my guest today. They're like, "Oh, he's so cute!" And it's amazing. It's God, it's over 40 years that they're putting out a new album with him. And my guest is Nick Heyward. How you doing, Nick?
I'm good, Steve. How are you?
Good. I can't believe I listened to the album. I really dig it. You still have that great sound. You had the sound that that attracted me to you guys when I first heard you. So, what made you decide to finally come out with this album?
Well, it wasn't really a decision. It kept getting made for us because we've had so many attempts at getting back together, and we can get back together. We find it really easy to get back together because Les Graham and I are old mates. So we're like genuine friends that sort of sat around a coffee table many years ago, many moons ago, and we were one band. And then there were another band, and there were another band, and there were another band. And this night, we decided to be Haircut 100. Let's take that name out. Let's drive to Beckenham to the Three Tons, which was David Bowie's lab. That's where he practiced his art, his kind of pop art early in the early days. And now this is a pub in South London. And we're drinking there, and we're saying to our friends, and they said, "What are you this week?" And we said, "We're Haircut 100," and they'll go, "Why?" And so we had the name. That was it. It stuck. And what made it different this time was it was a 40th anniversary, so we knew it was there was gonna we were gonna all get together again, but there was no. I don't think anybody got their hopes up that it would stay together, or that what was about to happen was going to happen, which was a series of events where we played at the Shepherd's Bush Empire and it sold out. The BBC Piano Room invited us to come on and do two songs with an orchestra, and then we got a phone call from Melvin Tubb from Hall of Nothing Management, who said, "Do you need any help?" So all the things that we were missing in the past were just seemed to disappear from just turning up this time. This time felt different. It'd been the previous time in about 2008, 9, and 10. That felt like a bit of a struggle. I mean, but we were recording, so we got some great recordings there, and that was the beginning of Boxing the Compass, right there. So we recorded Rain Cloud, A Wonderful Life, and That's a Start in those sessions with my son, Oliver Heywood, and Tufty Evans in a studio in Shiplake and Cookham, which is where we played, which was kind of around a meadow. We played, it wasn't a cricket game green, it was a meadow. And partly it's underwater as well, part of the year, so it's called a moor. And that was what it was, so we played there. But we couldn't keep it together again because we didn't have a manager. So we didn't. So that was why this time, with Melvin at the helm, lovely Melvin, who's not with us now, he's up in power pop heaven, but he's still kind of managing us because we still say, "What would Melvin do?"
So originally, why did the band part ways? Was it your solo career, or I read something where you were depressed, or why did you part ways? Because you guys were like, you were huge. I mean, you were like the MTV sensation. You were a giant band. So what happened?
That you've got the answer right there. It was huge. It was a giant band, and we didn't have a manager. And that was where the issues began. And so, if you don't have a manager of a band, whoa, good luck. Good luck, studio. So we didn't, we fell apart.
So you fell apart, and then they ended up recording an album without you. Now, did that hurt you? Did you feel betrayed somewhat? Because I would think, you were the face of the band. I mean, what was that like? I'm thinking because you're a young guy back then. You're still young, but you're a young guy. But what went through your head when that happened? Was it like, oh man, they're my mates. What are they doing to me?
Well, it's what they wanted. So, I didn't stand in their way. And I wouldn't say, I mean, especially not in hindsight, I wouldn't use the word betrayal. I mean, fucked off, probably. There was a lot of fucked off from everybody, and that was the whole reason why there wasn't any, there wasn't, it was better to be sort of relaxed and calm and fun and excited and everything that the band was in the beginning. And that's what it is now. There's no fucked off there. And if any of us would ever get that coming, we're mature enough to just kind of like go. So more of an eye roll now than acting on it as a young, impetuous being, where you can't really manage yourself, let alone be managed as a band,
Now, what's it like when you guys first did get back together? Because once again, was it you just picked? I mean, you said the first time was a little stressful, but did you really pick up? I mean, when did you start really picking up that you really sync together? Because I would think it's a long layoff, and you weren't together. I mean, how did it feel when you first started playing together, and how long do you really felt like you were back in that groove?
Well, it's immediate because we're a real band and always have been. So we just play, it's timeless. We get into a room and we start playing, and it's like, okay. But actually, up and running, I think we're really enjoying the show being as good as it's getting. I mean, it's good now. I mean, we're getting better and better. And I mean, the American dates are wild, really wild when we play them. And that's really encouraging when we have that. That enthusiasm comes back, so we can feel that energy. Now that energy is coming towards us, and it's just reciprocated. It's just like, well, this is a really positive thing going on here. This is mutual. It's like being in a relationship, and it's something like, well, I love them as much as they love me, and vice versa. It's like really, really good. And when it's not. It's a struggle. You'd like it to be different, but like in the early days when you're first starting and you're playing somewhere in the club, it's up to you to sort of just, I don't know, be the best you can be. But in the back of my mind, our mind, we did need to impress. It was all about needing to impress that way. Whereas now we just do the best we can and love what we do. And in loving what we do, which is playing those songs and playing all songs, I mean, the new ones slot in really well. They just kind of, it's just like there's no been no time in between. That 44 years wasn't there when they go in the set now, and they go really fit really, really well together. I mean, we just did a UK tour and it was brilliant, if I say so myself, because I can, because it's being in a band. That's what I love about the difference between being band and being on your own. I'd never say that about myself.
Right.
It's a bit like a child, where you can say, my child's great, you can do that, but sort of personally, it just feels it's wrong. But it's especially English. I mean, I've got an American wife, and she doesn't mind saying that about herself. It's like an inner confidence and stuff and positivity. But in the English education system in the 70s, you're just brought up to think, the encouragement is not on the curriculum, so.
Funny, I had a friend, he's passed since then. I know him as an LA named English Dave. And we used to say to him, how are you doing, Dave? And he'd always be like, miserable. And we're like, I mean, it became like a joke. We're like, but you're living in Southern California, you have a good job. How are you always miserable? And true, it's just that disposition. It'd be like, cheer up,
It's
man.
genuine. It's genuine.
So, how was the writing process for this album? Because you you're the did you write most of the songs? And you, because you also had a lot of solo albums, so I'm wondering how was the process when you went to writing back for Haircut 100, because you know your solo career was basically it was you.
Yeah, well, I'm the songwriter in the band. Like Blair is the drummer, Les is the bass player, Graham is the guitarist, and I'm the singer-songwriter and guitarist. So we've all got roles that we play, but as a band, it comes together. So when now with this album, when we all just got into a room sometimes, it was just like, okay, let's just make this up. Let's be a band. So all four of us now in this room are songwriters. We're all making this work. Even though I'm going to have to take this and make a song out of it, it's still that process. So some of them were like that. Some of them I had prepared earlier, like a Soulbird I had prepared during COVID. It was pretty much finished because I was going to do a, I was working on a solo album funded by my Patreons, because it was the time when we all thought that was it with music. You know, we're all unemployed. What are we going to do? So I was just thought, well, I want to make music, so I haven't got any money to make music, so barely paying the mortgage, that's what I think. So it's like, okay, well, Patreon. And it was a fantastic, it's a great idea. It's fantastic for artists. It's like, how am I going to get the art funded? So thankfully to the Patreons that they are part of this. That's why they're thanked on the album sleeve, that they're part of the actual creative process of this, because they allowed it to happen. I wouldn't have been working overseas, you know, that I was working with the guy that I'd done Wooden Echoes with. So that was it was just a thankfully it just to them it was it happened. So I was able to pay for sessions, and you know, it was good.
Well, on the album, I love the coming rattle, the come back to me right out of the box, gets you in a good mood. And it almost sounds like it, when I was, is there a live audience attracted to that? Because it sounds like, I know you're on a stage, but tell me about that song. Because it starts off, it's the perfect start. You put it on and you go, oh, Haircut 100's back.
Ah, well, that's good, because it evolved that way. You know, it wasn't sort of like written that way. It started in a studio in around this area. Blair, Les, and I were having some spare time, and we're in a local studio, and it was a lovely sunny day, so we really didn't want to be in a rehearsal studio, and it was a quite a low budget one as well. And you know, it wasn't the nicest of surroundings, but that's some of the best songs have sometimes come out of, you know, it doesn't matter where you are, you know, you just got to turn up somewhere and start the creative process. And it came from just playing, and like I was playing a little riff, and Les came up with a something that sounded like the Sex Pistols almost. And you know, Blair's kind of being Stax, which is kind of it sounded a little bit Nobody's Fool, and it sounded like the where we left off. For me personally, anyway. So it evolved into a lot of work on that. I spent most of the summer and the winter just, you know, trying to write the lyrics on that one. It wasn't easy, because it's all I had was Come Back to Me. You know, it's like Come Back to Me, and it was kind of inspired by Atonement. You know, the film, when there's a scene in the movie where it's just Come Back to Me, Robbie, and Cecilia, I think it is, or Celia. So these are Cecilia, Keira Knightley's character, and James McAvoy, and they're in a cafe, and it's like they're having tea, and he's, you know, got post-traumatic stress disorder and beyond, and everything that's happened in the film. I don't know if you know the book and stuff, but the film, but wonderful, one of my favourite films, and this scene particularly kills me. So that's why I think why I was singing it, because it just, well, things like that just come when you're in the creative process of standing up and playing. But the rest of it, like, you know, I can't be literal. If I've got a film or a scene in mind, I can't just write it as a literal thing. So it has to come from You have to step aside and allow things to come in. So the fact that it felt like British culture and related to atonement of the band and sort of a redemption and healing, and stepping off stage at Hammersmith Odeon to the distant echoes of screams and adoration for the band, and then 44 years of echoing or lost at sea, and then coming back on stage 44, 45 years later, and kind of stepping on stage and Blair's still playing stacks, he's still there, and we're still doing what we do, and then I reintroduce the band, you know, hello, you know, we're Haircut 100, you know, are you ready? Let's go, and we're off again. It's like stepping on stage again, and then that song Come Back to Me finishes, and it's like car pulls up, boom, damn, we're back funking, you know, it's like, and we're off again. So where it goes from here, where does it go from here, you know?
My favorite song on it is A Wonderful Life. Tell me about that song. And it's funny because once again, it's so weird that that happens. The whole album's great, but then all of a sudden I'm enjoying the album, and then that's my favorite song, and that's the last song on the track.
Ah.
But tell me about that song, because it's just got a great sound. And one thing also, as I noticed, you still have, you have the funk and the jazz going, and you can still dance to your music. Like that was a big thing when, Boy Meets Girl came out. The dance floors in New Jersey and Philly, but people would go out and dance because it was a different kind of dance. But it still has a dance. You still have that danceable music. But tell me about A Wonderful Life, because that is my favorite.
Oh, okay. That's great. It well, that was one of the first ones. That was the early ones done, as I said, when around about two, you know, late 2000 and sort of 8, 9, 10, around that period when we went to local studios and recorded Rain Cloud, That's a Start, and A Wonderful Life. And I put it at the end because it started, it's like it's sandwiched between two cinematic events, you know, and there's this moment where James Stewart, I saw it on YouTube, where he talks about A Wonderful Life, and he talks about cinema being moments and moments in films, and he made that moment where he's lost everything, you know, and then he realizes what life would be like, you know, had he not lived in this town, had he not been in this band, so to speak, this family. And so, therefore, that realization I just wanted to capture in a song without it being, again, a literal thing about, you know, because it's the film, It's a Wanderful Life. But I just wanted to encapsulate, you know, a wonderful life, and that it has been, and what a wonderful band, and what a wonderful moment to be back in it and doing it. And if it's just that, you know, two cinematic moments in between the band, because none of us, and that includes you, Steve, or any, or none of us know whether we'll be here in an hour, you know? So we just got to live. And so, you know, I'm making stuff, we're making stuff, everybody's making stuff as we go along. But to end and, because it's like 10 chapters in a book, you know, I always think of, like, once I get the narrative, then you've got a piece of, you've got an album. And I know albums aren't a thing anymore. And I know people, you know, because I see the stats, I see people just play, you know, 2 seconds of one song and flit. And, you know, the chances of having a whole song played now or a whole album is quite a rare thing. It's probably only a certain generation of people that do it, or some young people that just are getting into the concept of an album again. But people aren't finding it struggle to read a book, even, let alone, you know, listen to a whole album and the narrative of it. But that doesn't stop us doing that as a concept, because we were brought up on albums, you know, and that concept. I mean, I've listened to so many albums where I feel like I've been on a complete, it's just, I'm involved, I'm in this, you know, and it's reflecting in back in life with everything you're going through, and it's resonating, and it's once you're in, and you, it's like a book, you know, you'll always love that book. So with that song, it was a bit like I never thought I'd never find out what life's about and what it really means. So it just encapsulates that feeling. And yeah, and that was it. It went down really easily, that one, Steve, that song. It was recorded really well.
You know, you said something. You said something about the albums, and you're right. And that's something that this generation. I, my wife Joe Strawn says, I'm becoming the get off my lawn guy, but she's. It's like they're missing out because so many albums. You're right. You would get so. I mean, we would just listen to the albums, and you would look at the artwork, and you would read, and if it had the lyrics, you were totally stoked because it's like, oh my God, this is what they're saying, and that really sucks. And that's what I love albums, and I'm glad you put the album together. I'm glad you put it this way because, you know, and I love your story that it's the beginning and the ending, and it's like a book because a lot of people don't look at it that way. And now, with your chapters, your songs, how has your writing changed over the years? Because you've been at this game for a long time. You started, you know, you've had the early success with Haircut 100, that success with your solo albums. Now you have this album. But you, have you grown as a writer? Do you put your, I mean, of course, as you said, A Wonderful Life, Come Back to Me, it reflects on your time with the band. But in your other songs and with your solo career, how have you evolved, shall we say, as a songwriter?
I enjoy the process more, and I've gone through so many different stages where I've actually really enjoyed almost sketches, almost doodles, music-wise, where it's so easy to now record at home, you know, with a mic and just press record and make stuff up. And I've really enjoyed doing that process. I haven't shared a lot of that. I used to do that on MySpace. I loved working on a song during the day and then sharing it that day. And so I love those instant sketches and sharing them. An album is different. It's really involved, it seems. I think people realize there's a you're making an album, so there's a different energy to it. And I enjoy that. I mean, I enjoy all of it really, and it's evolved. I suppose the listeners can it's up to them really. I mean, I feel like I can't do anything else other than what I'm doing, and so I'm just enjoying what I do and doing the best and then sharing it. I mean, I've got lots of unfinished songs that I'd like to finish now, you know. I mean, it was down to 10, but I mean, we still got like four or five haircut ones that will go on the next one if there's the next one. If this does well, and if there's a similar situation in music to be able to do it, because you know we love the whole idea of albums and making albums. I mean, that was what our goal was. That was our dream when we were kids, to make albums like we listened to. It wasn't really singles as much. I mean, they're really great things. Magical things, but they come off albums. And so you always listen to, it's a bit like listening to the B-side when you would do that. It's like what's the band really like, and you want to start getting into them and finding out what they're like more and musically, and you know, and discovering other songs on albums, you know, like you know, you might have it a year or something, an album, and then you another song that was completely hidden, that was right in front of your ears, and a year later it's got in. And the other one that you loved instantly is they're just like partners, aren't they? I mean, you know, it's or people, these songs become people.
Well, it's funny. It's also like, you know, the early Led Zeppelin album when Heartbreaker goes straight into Live and Love and the Maid's a Woman or whatever. It sounded right. But then you'd hear it on the radio and they would just play one and you'd be like, hey, wait a second, you're not doing this partnership. And it's funny because you get attached to the songs like that.
I mean, and that's it. And if a song has got into you and got deep in it, you just love that band or those artists or whoever it is. It's not, you know, I mean, you can be in denial of it, but it's in there, isn't it? You know, you've loved it. I mean, I've fallen in love with so many songs that unlikely, unlikely bands and things, and you just go, I love that.
Give me a few of them. I'd
Bands.
like to hear what you thought was unlikely, some songs you fell in love with that you just surprised you.
Well, I mean, even like, I love that Sad Cafe song. Every day without you, na 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 na. Just, oh, wonderful songs, and I wasn't at that time going out and getting Sad Cafe's album because, punk was kicking off and new wave, and I was listening to Girls Talk, and I was listening, I had all these records that I loved and all this stuff, and it was to do with the culture and everything. But, I was still listening to If You Leave Me Now by Chicago and going, melting, absolutely melting with the brilliance of it, and just going, this is, and or How Deep Is Your Love by Bee Gees, it was just right in there, but was I buying Bee Gees records? I mean, or ELO records at that time? No, but they sounded so warm, and these guys had been perfecting their craft for so long, and they were making these amazing sounding records. And there I was, pogoing at gigs, was kind of thing, and going to, oh, actually, I never pogoed really.
But
I
it's
went a
funny.
bit
It's
like that once.
funny how deep is your love. That actually, I got me and my wife's 7th anniversary is coming up. That was our wedding song. And that's something that I never really listened to. But when we were coming up with a wedding song, we're thinking, what do we want to hear? And it's funny how it sticks to you and you remember that song. And then I saw the documentary about the Bee Gees, how they wrote that song when like the light came in. And I just like, oh, this makes sense.
It's
So,
special. It's very special, that song.
oh, yes, it
Yeah,
is.
that
Now,
H was it with the HBO? Was it the HBO
yes.
documentary? I saw that and did have the same moment, and it was Sarah and I's song, one of ours as well. And it's like when it gets in there, it's just like it's a really important question. How deep is your love?
So, what made you want to get into music? You're a creative guy, I can tell, but when you were a kid, did you always want to be a musician, or what made you choose this path?
Very musical family. Dad was into big band jazz. Mum was into the Carpenters, and my brother was into Pink Floyd and rock, and Zeppelin and Montrose and all these brilliant rock bands and stuff. And so I was into, I mean, the first. So it was always around, and we were always going. I mean, Dad took me to see Count Basie, Ray Charles, Oscar Peterson, around about 71, and there was always jazz in the car. There was always Pink Floyd in the car. So if you've got Pink Floyd, Dark Side of the Moon in the car, and you're driving anywhere, it doesn't matter where you're going, the outside looks effing amazing and feels amazing because that music makes the world a better place. So you're looking out the window, and it's like, you've got Dark Side of the Moon soundtrack. You go, whoa, 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 greatest gig in the sky, and you're just going, what planet am I on? This is a brilliant place. And then without the music, it's just like there's Woolworths. Okay, it's dismal, it's dark, it's rainy, it's cold, it's Brixton. Okay, so that's what got me into music: the fact that it was in the family and it was in the car. So it was in my condition. It was in my heart and soul, it was in there. And so therefore my love of music just started. And right from the off, I kind of wanted to, I mean, I've met up with mates since. I met up with a mate, John Chalkley, at Palladium when we played there not so long ago. He said, you were always starting bands. And it's that thing, my brother was doing it, I was doing it. Music was big. I mean, I bought Dad a saxophone once, but he didn't start a band, but he just, he put the saxophone on the wall and then wore the strap to the jazz club. So,
Now, how did your band, how did Haircut 100 get their first record deal? Because was it, it was a different time. As we said, record deals are completely different, and the music industry wasn't the most honest. It wasn't like record executives were great guys that you would invite over for dinner. So how did you guys get your first record deal?
Well, I think it all kicked off with the NME. There was an NME article by Adrian Thrills. Lovely chap, brilliant writer. And I had a bold moment, Steve. I just went into the NME and it sort of changed everything. It's kicked off from there, and by the end of the year, we had pretty much every major record company offering us a record contract. And the previous before that, we couldn't get an agent or anyone. We couldn't get anything. We had nothing, nothing, no thing. So it's all, I think, stemmed from that moment. So when we actually had got the record deal, there was a huge buzz about the band. So it's quite not going to say easy, because it was, it's never easy, but it just felt like, we were attracting this. It felt like, and I think it all stemmed from that moment of just all things stem from a bold moment. Like say you meeting your wife, it's like, it's that bold moment, isn't it? Partner. It's, when you meet your partner, it does take a bit of a bold move, doesn't it?
Oh yeah, I mean it's
No,
that's the deal. You're right,
it
but
does.
see, you know what's funny when you say about that? You said it takes the bold move, but once again, people don't understand that you guys had the talent to back it up. There's a lot of people make a bold move and they just suck, but they liked your sound, so that's the one thing you guys knew you were ready to, do it, which was great for you guys. Now I want to talk about Love Plus One, the video. I know that was that's where I first saw you guys. I don't really the videos. You're swinging on a vine. I mean, tell me about that video. What you thought? Because videos weren't. I mean, I think back then you'd make a video, but you wouldn't think that it would live on forever. And then we'd get something called YouTube, and millions of people would see it on MTV, All America. Tell me what was going through your mind when you were making that video, and is it something you look back and you go, "Oh man, I wish we did it different," or are you just totally happy with it? Because I love the video, but you're the
Well,
star of it. So tell me about the video.
if you're going to get your top off, get your top off when you're 20. Don't get it off when you're 65. It's not good. That's the time. So I'm pleased I did that then. And got into a loincloth. That's around about the age that you get into loincloths. I've had loads of guys saying that was the moment I knew I was gay, which was, so I've helped some guys, realize themselves, which that feels good. We didn't have much to do with it. Otherwise, I think we wouldn't have probably come up with those ideas, because it didn't seem to be anything like the band at all. But we were so busy at that time, we were just turning up to places, and then, like, what we're doing today, oh, we're making a video, okay, well, and then we just do it, and next you're standing in a loincloth, and then you're on a haystack, and whatever you're doing, and you're just going with it and making it up on the spur of the moment and having the fun with it. But yeah, did we think that that was going to be, on MTV, and there was going to be a thing called MTV? I mean, no, you just don't. Or YouTube with people seeing it. No, none of this. So it was just one fantastic day in 1982. One of many fantastic days that just some crazy things happened, where the wardrobe man said, "Les, I think you should wear this," and saying that, it was only the loincloth really that was, been forced into. Because then again, I think there was dancing around a pot, wasn't there? Like somebody being boiled or something like that. And I can remember. Yeah. So there was some changes. It wasn't. I think we were all made to look pretty ridiculous, and stuff. But like I say, that's the age to do it. Completely.
And as I said, it made an imprint on me, and because I heard the music through the video. Now I want to hear about the first time you guys were on Top of the Pops, because I'm always fascinated, because my background is stand-up comedy, and back in the day when the Tonight Show was on, if a comic you knew got on the Tonight Show with Johnny Carson, their career changed. Especially when before I even started, I would watch them as a kid. So what was it like for Top of the Pops? Because you probably watched that, seeing your musical family, you probably watched that a lot. Was the excitement there, and was there an anxiousness that came with it, or tell me about that.
Yeah, there was. It was both at the same time. It's quite an overwhelming experience because you've seen this program and grown up with it, and you can't believe it, you're actually on it. And I loved being on it. I thought I loved it. I mean, it was hard to watch it back. It was the beginning of finding it really hard to watch any kind of performance. And be sort of critical of it and be professional about it and think, oh, I could maybe adjust that there or do that. I just wasn't really able to do that right from the beginning. I remember just going, oh, I can't really look, but we were doing so many of those things at that particular time. I was getting conditioned to it and, like an airplane, like flying. You just kind of. You do it so much that you get used to it, whereas you might be a bit, is this, am I going to be okay with this? Because this is all change when you're younger. It's all stuff that you're just doing and you're learning on the fly, so to speak. When the cameraman said, just, he was kind of a clipboard, and he was saying, just keep your eye on the orange light, darling. So it's like the orange light comes on the camera, and it's like you look there, and then you look there. And now, before then, I didn't go to orange light class, or TV class. So I had no training in being what it was. So you were, it just would feel like it assumed that you knew what you were doing. This is your chosen pathway in life. This is what you're a band. So you just know, and you just don't. So you just have to learn quickly on the fly. I'm going to learn how to do this. I'm going to learn how to be a flyer. I'm going to learn how to travel. I'm going to learn how to, and you've got to work it out somehow. And it's not easy because nobody taught you how to stay up all night and then go on the telly the next day or in the morning and just do that and do it every day and remain buoyant and stuff like that. You're learning as you go and going, oh, so this is what being in music is like. This is what being, for want of a better word, a pop star is. Okay, I get it, right. It takes you by surprise because you don't know what it's like. When you watch David Bowie on TV and you go, wow, that looks amazing. Oh my God, imagine doing that. And then when you're doing it, it's like a completely different experience. It's something similar, something like you thought it would be. But like a fantasy, it's not reality, is it?
What was it like for you when you guys started getting so popular? Your private life, were people, when you went out in public, I mean, were people swarming you? Did people recognize you? It's one of those things. You're young, you're a good-looking band. People see you on the TV. It's not like before, we would just hear stuff on the radio, especially in America, or see them like on the Midnight Special or Don Kirshner's rock concert. You wouldn't really have that visual. What was it like for you guys, especially you, because you were the front man? What was it like for you going out in public after your success really hit it?
Well, I was playing with it. I was running with it. It was I took it seriously. I enjoyed it, and the opposite, and all the stuff in between, all the colors of the rainbow and all the colors, shades of gray, all in the middle. It was everything. It was so different every other day. There was a kind of consistency to it, but it was random. It felt random doing it, and I was learning. It was hard. I mean, and I was the guy championing the band at after midnight, talking to somebody about things and till 3, and then trying to go to sleep, but not. And Yeah, so I was running on nervous energy, really, you know. So I wasn't so good at pacing, you know. Who is at that age, you know? You get told to sort of health. I mean, in 1982, health wasn't a thing, you know. Nobody wanted to be healthy in that way. That sleep, what are you talking about? You know,
You
it's
look back,
far too exciting.
we
Yeah,
used to
this is
always look
way
back,
too exciting.
you look back and you go, oh yeah, we get in at 3 and we be at work at 7. Now it's like I get in at 3 in the afternoon. Honestly, I mean, it's just funny, we don't think back, and we're on an adrenaline. I think we were always on adrenaline. I think that's what I think, we were excited about life, and as you get
Yeah.
older, you're still excited about life, but your body can't take it.
Yeah, exactly. That's it, exactly, you know. So back then it was just like there's probably something in the back of your mind as well. I felt like, okay, well I've seen how transient this world is, how like you can come and then go, and there's been bands that have been here and then gone because I'd like them myself. So I knew you had a like certain amount of time. You had your moment. So that's probably in the back of your mind, you know. I mean, maybe there was also that feeling of, oh, we're gonna be Beatles, etc. But you know, even they had 10 years, you know, and you get your time. So you don't know how long you're gonna be doing this. You think it's forever, you know. Like everything, you think you're gonna live forever, to quote Oasis. You know, I don't know anybody that thinks, oh, well, I've probably got like 23 years. So, yeah, you've got a kind of rough figure that you think you're going to be here for, and you kind of live accordingly. And that's not always good. I haven't got that now. I'm li living every day. But I've definitely had that feeling like, oh, I'm probably going to be, I don't know, very old. You know what I mean? And you think, I've got lots of time. And then you get to 60 and you go, better get on. Better
It's
get
true.
on with that.
Now, you guys are touring. How does it feel as an artist when you see people at the show who have followed you for 40 years, and then they bring their kids, and they maybe bring their grandkids? How does that make you feel as an artist that your music made an imprint? Because, and right now there's such a surge in 80s shows, because, well, the 80s were a great time. I'm going to ask you about that in a second. But how does it make you feel when you're on stage and just you notice like these there's
Yeah.
people of all different ages that appreciate you?
Well, it makes us all feel warm and cozy, and we talk about that, you know, and we talk about it after the gig as well, that like Jonesy is spotting people in the audience, say, did you see that lovely family down the front? And Les said, I saw somebody crying, you know, as soon as the song came on, they just burst into tears, and they were just looked so overwhelmed with like tears of joy, you know, that thing of this is their whole life now coming up to this moment and they're hearing it. And that connection is what keeps us going. You know, it's a beautiful thing because it was not expected either. You know, it wasn't a plan. No band plans to split up for 44 years. And then come back and start playing again, and especially in, well, playing. We never thought we'd get to play America again. Now, after we got back last time, it was like, and then it ended. It was just kind of like so sad that we weren't going to go back to America and fulfill our potential there. And so that was why it made it when we went back there the first time with Howard Jones, and we played with him, and we were playing in. It was just like we going back to LA because that's where we felt like it was. We'd left LA, and we sort of, you know, flew out. I remember the flight so well, you know, and we got pictures of it, you know, where you're just all the band. I used to love those moments when you're all asleep at the end of a tour, you know, and to see pictures of it, it's really heartwarming. It's just like you're asleep like squirrels. in a nest, you know, in a tree, a flying tree, and you're on the way home after you've done good work, you know, you've buried lots of nuts. No, you know.
So, what do you think made the 80s so special? I'm a guy, I graduated high school in the 80s and I graduated college in the 80s. And, you know, as I said, there's such a big 80s fan base. There's a woman in Philly named Pam Biasi. She runs, they call them the Losties. It's Lo Robert Drake's radio show. And she always posts on about the 80s because she has like an 80s museum in her house. And so, you know, for us, we know what it is because we listened to the music. The music affected us, the fashion. But for you, what do you think made the 80s so special?
Does she make banana cake?
Yes. Yeah. She, yeah,
I
you know
love
her.
her. Yes,
She gave, she gave, she gave banana cake to Martin Ware. I know she gives him from heaven. So she gave him, yeah. So, yeah. So if you're in
Well, she
Philly,
tried to give me cake when I'd had food poisoning. And I was like, that's lovely. And I did take it. And I was like looking at it. I thought it was the sweetest thing ever. But I couldn't actually eat it because when I met her, I was so off. And I'm not normally like that. It was like rare to get anything like that. But I did have food poisoning. It was hard. It was touch and go whether I made it on stage. I mean, they had a bucket at the side of the stage. But yeah, stuff like that is just, I think that's what makes America great. You know.
But what made the 80s that generation so great? The time when we lived there, because I mean, so many people are like, oh, I'd go back to the 80s in a second. I wouldn't, except I had hair back then, I'm bald. But now, but that's why I wouldn't go. But what do you think made the 80s so special?
It was naive. It had a tinge of naivety and solidarity, you know. And the competitiveness was healthy. It felt like healthy competitiveness. And you know, we were in it was a decade when you had E.T., you know, you had all those films that were so full of hope. The 16 Candles and all those songs that were about the youth culture that was happening. When you look at it now, it's so naive. And you can't believe how naive it is. It's just like we were lucky to have that naivety, to have Back to the Future. One, two, three, and four, you know, to have all those great actors at that particular period. Oh, look at them. I mean, know, we lived in an age with Marty McFly, you know. So we were charmed, you know. And I would imagine that people look back at the 60s in a similar way and 70s, but the 80s had something optimistic about it. It felt like something was always going to happen and it was going to be good. It was going to be good because it came from a good place. And then it compared to the cynicism and sinister sort of feeling and sight that the internet has brought along with it, like the duality of both things. You know, you've got incredible, you know, I can see so many ducks and cats and wonderful things on the, you know, I mean, it's like endless, you know, the sweetness that the naivety and innocence that you can find on social media and optimism and brilliant music and all that wonderful stuff. And yet the other stuff that you can do too, and it's a reflection of that. And with AI coming in, you know, we all think like, well, AI can be great, used, you know, for good. AI for bad, it's like, oh, let's all get our coats now, you know, and leave the planet because it's not looking good. So I know we had nuclear war threats and that kind of stuff around then, but there was definitely more solidarity within everyone, and there was accountability and solidarity, and it was cherished. There were things like Live Aid that could happen out of such a decade. And I know that Live Aid has come under lots of criticism, politically and stuff, but it comes from a good place, as in you know, you can criticize it, but it's still giving, you know, it's still help, and it stills solidarity. It's people coming together, and those kind of causes have been criticized and have gone through cynicism now. So when I think when we do look at that period, it just felt so generally, I mean, I remember America in that period. It was so, I mean, it was a thing. I mean, personally, for me, it was a thing to just go to the place that Happy Days and American Graffiti and all these wonderful bands that I've grown up with and TV programs, I was like, he looks like Shaft, and I grew up thinking, why don't I look like Shaft? That's like, I can't be that cool. Why can't I look like Robert De Niro, in Taxi Driver and all these things? And getting feels like One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest and thinking, so America was just this, oh, it was like to actually go there. I never thought it was a dream. So then to just to go there and amazing. So yeah, lost my train of thought there. I was reminiscing. I was in America in nineteen
Well, you're
eighty
going to be
two.
back soon. So that's good. So you'll be back and you'll
Yeah.
be getting into it. Now, I have one final question. I always ask my guests this before I wrap up. Looking back at your life, and this can be both professional and personal, what makes you proud? What is Nick Heyward proud of?
Career-wise, because I mean, I could just now talk about my three children and grandchildren for till the cows come home.
Well,
But
just okay. Well, so we
yeah.
know that you're the kids. Okay. And
Yeah.
that makes sense, but what
Yeah.
career-wise, and you as a human, what makes you proud?
I'm really proud of the four of us playing together again and being together long as we have now and continuing and keep turning up. I'm proud of us because it's we're not in it for the money because there isn't any money. We're in it for the at the moment we're in it because we love doing it and we know that it's there's no I don't I think all of us are thinking we're in it now we're in this and we know what it's like to not do this so we so we just keep going and it is atonement so it's lovely it's resolution. It feels good, and we're learning about ourselves through that process. That's what I feel. It's like so that I'm proud of that as a band. I'm proud of working with Jeff Emerick because the further away that from that moment in 1983 when they're working together, it was just I realized what a brilliant producer and wizard he was and to work with and so I'm really proud of that. There's so much I'm proud of. I'm proud of that I'm still doing it. That's amazing. And I'm proud to be playing with Squeeze because I love them. It's like if you'd have said to me like back in nine probably round about when I'm sitting watching Top of the Pops, watching Up the Junction. If you'd have said that you will be playing with them, or first in 2 years' time, you'll be on Top of the Pops, and they'll be asking you if you could support them on tour, and you'd say yeah, but then you're too busy, and then 44 years later, it happens. I wouldn't,
Awesome.
you can't, yeah. Like,
Well, you know what? I got to tell you, the final track on Boxing the Compass, The Wonderful Life, you've had one. So, how can people get your album? How can people find all about you?
all on haircut100.com or nickhayward.com. It's all on there, or it goes from there outwards, like a ripple effect. Woo.
So, people, go get the album. Just go see the tour. It's a great tour. Go to my website, coopertalk.net. You can find 1,071 episodes. You can email me at
How many?
coopertalk.net. What's that?
How many?
1,071. So see
High
that?
five.
See, no, all right. See, I'm going to air high five. And so go check it out and email me at cooper, coopertalk.net. Remember, I'm Steve Cooper. I'm only as hip as my guest. And don't forget, drink your water, Eat your vegetables, take your vitamins, and I'll talk to you next time.